Harry S. Truman, President of the United States, dedicate this day of Sunday to America, armed and free.
Nations that place their faith in treaties and fail to keep their hardware up don't stick around long enough to write very many pages in history. It is not equality in power that reduces hostility and conflict. Rather, it is power dominance or submission. Peace is purchased by making yourself stronger than your adversary, or by dismantling power and submitting to one's enemies. Power is not only sufficient military strength, but a sound economy, a reliable energy supply and credibility, the belief by any potential enemy that you will not choose surrender as the way to maintain peace. To abdicate power is to abdicate the right to maintain peace.
I am a minute man. I am the guardian of America, armed and free. For we knew it will always be the citizen who is the guardian of America.
Welcome to America Armed and Free, a program dedicated to preserving your God-granted, constitutionally guaranteed individual right to keep and bear arms in defense of self or state, understanding that the citizens are the militia. This program is produced by Charles Heller and is not endorsed by anyone who isn't pro-choice on freedom.
We are the guardians of America, armed and free.
This is a solemn but a glorious hour. The Allied Army, through sacrifice and devotion, and with God's help, has wrung from Germany a final and unconditional surrender. The flags of freedom fly all over Europe. For this victory, we join in offering our thanks to the providence which has guided and sustained us through the dark days of adversity.
Colonel Lee Archer is one of the original Tuskegee Airmen, a unit of the Army Air Force of World War II that never lost a bomber on an escort mission. Colonel Archer has the distinction of being the first black ace in the American Army, later the Air Force. It is a joy, a pleasure, and a very special honor to welcome to the telephones and microphones of America Armed and Free, Colonel Lee Archer. First of all, thank you for your long years of service to our country in uniform. You make all of us proud, sir. I don't know if you were able, due to the clarity of the phone line or the clarity of that recording, to hear the recording of President Truman's announcement that we had won the war on Europe. Did that come down the phone line very clearly?
It came through perfectly, the song and the speech.
Good. I'm really glad that both did. Did you by any chance hear President Truman's announcement of that?
No. At the time, I was away on duty.
You were a little busy at the moment.
A little busy at the time.
Yeah. But I just want the audience to realize that you had a very direct part in causing it. Did you have a sense of that in World War II, that you had actually been a piece of such an important working part in history? Or did that not dawn on you till years later?
Oh, no. At the time, I was just a young man with a bunch of other young men that was doing what we were supposed to do. The country was in trouble, and we wanted to serve. I guess our biggest problem was we wanted to serve in a certain part of the service which really didn't want us.
Oh, boy, did it ever not want. But, boy, did you ever stuff it down their throat in a nice way, in a positive direction.
It wasn't done to embarrass the government or anything. It was just to say we could, okay, if you say we can't do it, let us try and show us that we can.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll show you that we can.
Yeah, I don't think excellence is ever meant to be a goof you. Would you please tell us how you came to be among the pilots of the 332nd Pursuit Squadron?
No, let me correct that. I mean, people have it that they're wrong. It's the 332nd Pursuit Group.
Group,
that
okay.
Was the first one, and up until 44 and 45 when they changed us to fighters. To tell you the whole long story is very simple. The war was coming on in 1940 and 41, and I knew, in fact, most of the young men that I knew in school with me were of the opinion that, okay, we're going to have to get in this sooner or later, and what do? We wait for a draft, or do we volunteer? Some of us took the number one, wait for a draft, and maybe escape it, or maybe it wouldn't involve America, or go in. The people who went in with the idea, I think, because it happened with most of my friends, into a service they wanted. Navy, Air Force, Army, because we wanted to fight for the country. And I had picked the Army Air Corps because I'd been an airplane buff as a young man, a little model builder and things like that. And truthfully, had a background from my father's record in World War One, in which he ended up in an infantry organization. And his story of that war and the infantry made me really want to be an Air Force pilot, Army Air Corps pilot.
Mm-hmm.
So I volunteered to go to the Army Air Corps, and they refused me. I didn't know why, because I joined with two other friends of mine who were white college students. I knew what our grades were on the testing and the physical and all, and they got called and I didn't, and I made myself a pest to the recruiting people. And finally they informed me that due to a 1925 war college study, that no people of color, no colored people in those days would be in the Army Air Corps. There was no unit they could be assigned to. They had no plans on ever having a unit. And they had this 1925 War College study, which indicated that certain groups of Americans, Orientals as they called them in those days, and African Americans, colored, and things like that, couldn't do and wouldn't be accepted. I ended up going into the infantry and decided to make the best of it. I was in the infantry down in a place called Camp Wheeler in Georgia in an organization that became rather well known, the 16th Battalion, and I was a telegrapher and a field communication network man. And I became an instructor after I graduated from the school at Camp Wheeler. Incidentally, Camp Wheeler was a segregated base also, had 16 battalions. And the 16th was the black battalion, and it was not anywhere near the rest of the 15 on the base, separated. And so while I was there in 42, the Air Force decided to do what we call the Tuskegee Experiment. Mrs. Roosevelt, the president's wife, had met a gentleman at Tuskegee, where she was visiting the Tuskegee Institute, the black college in Tuskegee, Alabama. His name was Alfred Anderson, and he was one of the few blacks in America who had a pilot's license. He and a dentist and a woman in Chicago were there. And Tuskegee had a section that was called the Pilot's Training Detachment. It was one of the few black colleges that had this. There were about 100 of them all across the country, and I think 6 of them had this pilot's training, in which the government was trying to train young men only, to be pilots in the event that we got into the war. They were just doing a little pre-planning. They had not permitted any of the black colleges to participate in it until later on. Mrs. Roosevelt, who met Alfred Anderson, the one we called Chief.
You called who? What did you call him?
Chief.
Cheats?
Chief. C-H-I-E-F.
Uh-huh. Cheats.
Okay. In fact, if you read anything about Tuskegee Airmen, and it doesn't mention Alfred Anderson, all of us call him Chief Anderson. He was the chief pilot.
Ah.
Pre-flight and primary school.
Mm-hmm.
She met him, and he took her on a flight and proved to her he could. Now, we're not sure now whether she convinced President Roosevelt to order Hap Arnold, General Arnold, and the Air Corps, Army Air Corps, to start the Tuskegee program or experiment, as it was called, because she was doing good or because he was running for a third term, the first president in history who had violated George Washington's unwritten edict that a president should serve 2 terms and then go home.
Mm-hmm.
But anyhow, he ordered Hap Arnold, President Roosevelt orders Hap Arnold to do it. Now, this is where they made the mistake as far I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of saying, okay, we'll go back and get all these young men who have hassled us. In fact, two of them had sued the government of why they couldn't get into the Army Air Corps. And the rest of us had been giving them a lot of trouble. They decided then they would have the Tuskegee experiment.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of putting us in, instead of taking us in and putting us in all the units that were training young Air Force pilots all over the country, where they could have cherry-picked us one at a time, they, in their deliberate racist attitude, built a special base near this college at Tuskegee, Alabama, Tuskegee Institute, and sent all of us there. Well, not even the dumbest racist, as far as I was concerned, could believe that everyone sent there of color could not pass the test and all. So they couldn't cherry pick us one at a time. Someone had to graduate.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't. We were all well educated. We were all patriotic. We loved the country. We all wanted to fight for the country, and we were all physically in excellent shape.
Well, you know, the proof of that is look how long many of you have lived. You know, you're still in good physical condition at 85?
86.
86.
September the 6th was the birthday.
Oh, happy birthday.
Thank you. No, so it was. At first, the white instructors towed the line.
I don't mean to cut you short at all, Colonel Archer, but we're coming up on that first break in about 10 seconds, so.
Okay, well, just cut me off.
I'm not cutting you off. I'm just sort of delaying you for a little bit, but bear with us for just a second. The break's just about to start, and I want to hear every word, every second of what you have to say, because I think we can all learn from it. Not because of color, but because of what you overcame. I want to make that statement very clear. You're listening to AM 690 KVOI Tucson, AM 930 KAPR Douglas, AM 1240 KJAA Globe, AM 1100 KFNX Cave Creek Phoenix. National test results reveal almost half of Arizona's public school fourth graders can't read at basic levels, despite over $8,000 taxpayer dollars per student. The teachers' union says the answer is spending, yet schools are already 60% of Arizona's budget. School choice is a promising alternative. Charter school students make faster achievement gains than public school students. Giving parents a choice gives children a chance. Learn more at goldwaterinstitute.org. Can parents prevent schools from indoctrinating their children with harmful agendas? Dr. Karen Ephraim joins Charles Heller at 6 p.m. Sunday the 17th on Liberty Watch about controlling your local schools. At 7 p.m. on America Armed and Free, William Petro joins Charles about whether liberal or conservative makes a difference when it comes to gun laws and national progress. Liberty Watch and America Armed and Free, Sundays 6 to 8 p.m., AM 1100, KFNX, Cave Creek, Phoenix.
You're listening to America Armed and Free.
They were flying for me. They were flying for everyone. They were trying to see the brightest day for each and every one. They gave us their light. They gave us their spirit and all they could see. They were flying.
Welcome back to America Armed and Free on AM 690 KVOI Tucson, AM 940, 30 KAPR Douglas, AM 1240 KJAA Globe, and AM 1100 KFNX Cave Creek Phoenix. We have the joy, the pleasure, and the very special honor of having with us retired Air Force Colonel Lee Archer. He is one of the original Tuskegee Airmen. And for those of you who don't know who those people were, Google it. I'll just say a Mustang with a red tail. Right, Colonel Archer?
Correct.
Okay. So you were telling us as we walked into that break about the instructors and about cherry-picking and putting you all in a segregated environment rather than mainstreaming you into the body politic of pilots who are being trained.
That's correct. And the military then was just performing as the military had been for generations. My dad served in a segregated unit in World War I. in fact, went overseas and was refused by the American commanders and served with the French before they came home. So at Tuskegee, we had the same thing. Incidentally, Tuskegee taught most of us cadets and young African-American cadets and officers a lesson. The first commander was really as bad as the military could have had about his racial ideas and concepts. And he was actually so bad that the Army Air Corps relieved him. And they brought in another man by the name of Noel F. Parrish, poor Colonel Parrish at that time, Lieutenant Colonel and all, to take command of this special organization. He was a Southerner from Tennessee. He had been an Army enlisted pilot. He had been in the service for 10 or 15 years then. And in fact, before he even arrived at Tuskegee, his name was Mud. He came in and he talked to us and told us that he was the new commander and that he was there to see if we could learn to fly, if he could teach us to fly, and that he would do that. He would do us no favors, but he would treat us fairly.
Did he?
The most perfect example in the world. The man was a man of his word. In fact, the Tuskegee Airmen organization has a number of awards. And the number one award, most people think, would be named after Benjamin O. Davis, another minor god as far as we're concerned.
Yeah, Chappie.
Yeah, no, Davis.
Oh, Davis.
Benjamin O. Davis,
right.
Jr.
Right.
In the first class, one of the first five to graduate.
Ah. I was thinking of Chappie James. You're right.
Yeah, Chappie was in my class.
Right.
I'll come to him.
Mm-hmm.
The number one award is named the Noel Parrish Award. And people often say, well, why isn't it Ben Davis? Why is it Noel Parrish? And our answer is because Noel Parrish taught us a lesson. He was honest, straightforward. He was fair. And quite frequently, young people say, well, that's not a reason to give this person an award because he's fair. But it is when you think no one else is being fair. And I preach to young officers nowadays and young enlisted men that fairness should be the basis of anything they do. Not color, not race, not religion, not activity. Nothing else should matter. To treat a person as fairly as you could be treating them. This was probably one of the first successes we had, because all the attitudes of the other officers who might have had little racist ideas suddenly changed, and they started graduating a number of people. They formed two groups. First, the 99th Fighter Squadron. It was in those days the 99th Pursuit Squadron. And then, as they went overseas to North Africa, they were the first group to go over of the African Americans, and they went to North Africa, where their reception was a little shaky, as they say. I was not in that group. Then they formed a second group, because enough people graduated, to form the 332nd Fighters Group. Again, it was Pursuit Group. In those days. And those squadrons were the 100th, the 301st, and the 302nd Fighter Pursuit Squadron. Now, since World War One and the invention of the airplane, the fighters have been called pursuit. The concept being if you get in a fight with another fighter or a bomber, you never give up.
Mm-hmm.
He runs, you pursue him, if you have to pursue him home to his base. Right. And we did that kind of work. And we went overseas, and that's how it got. The 99th was in Africa at the time, and they were doing tactical work. They were attached to the 12th Tactical Air Force and flying C-40s. The 332nd went over a few months later, and they went to Italy, and they were flying P-39, Air Cobra.
Cobra, right.
Right. They then detached the 99th from the organization, from the white group they were with, and attached them to us. So we ended up with having four squadrons in the 332nd Fighter Group, the 99th, the 100th, the 301st, and the 302nd, when all other groups in the country and in all other countries had three squadrons to a group. We had four.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a commander by the name of Benjamin O. Davis, Jr., who was a West Pointer, who had come through West Point under one of the most demeaning systems in history. They call it the silent treatment. A person of color, no one spoke to him except to give him an order. He lived alone, slept alone, had to walk through the dining room every day and ask could he sit at table with the cadets, and often refused. And he was in the first five to graduate from this special program at Tuskegee. He had a long-range view that any error that we made, anything that we did out of negligence or stupidity would be examined more closely than anyone else doing the same thing. And he decided then that we would do the one thing that had to be done. We switched from the 12th Tactical Air Force to the 15th Strategic Air Force. That came about in 1944.
What was the effect of that?
The effect was that we stopped doing dive bombing and strafing and things like that and became escorts for bombers that were making the long-range bombing thing. Incidentally, up to then, the bombing missions had been accomplished under the British campaign, night bombing and spraying bombs all over the area. With the invention of the Norden bomb sight, it was decided by the Americans that bombing should not be against cities so much as it should be against infrastructure.
Mm-hmm.
Those things that made it possible for countries to fight a war. And they started the 8th Air Force in England and the 15th Air Force in Italy to do this. Suddenly, the bombers are making longer and longer runs, and the Germans are coming up and destroying them on the way to the target and back. At one time, when I was over there, I remember that one of the bomb groups, one of the bomb runs, lost 80 airplanes with 10 men on an airplane.
Yeah, 800 people in one mission, yeah.
Yes, and on one mission.
Yeah.
So they decided that we would change airplanes, and they got rid of the P-40s, which the 99th had been flying, and the 39s, which we had, which were good for down low work, and put us in the JUG, better known as the Republic
P-47
Thunderbolt.
Yep.
And we started flying that as escort. And the Germans learned pretty quickly that, okay, but these airplanes can only stay so long. It's a great airplane, and it was fine for what it was doing, but it couldn't stay with the bombers.
Mm-hmm.
So they then switched us again to the P-51 Mustang, which we painted our tails red. So everyone painted their tails different color. We just picked red. And now, under this system, we could stay with the bombers a long time. And under Ben Davis's rule was that you're no longer pursuit pilots, you're fighter pilots now. And you stay and fight enemies that come anywhere near the bomber rule. And he made it clear that he didn't care if no one ever became an ace or got a lot of victories, that his idea was that you stay with the bombers so that no one can destroy one. And that was it.
And
that was our rule, and we lived by it.
To my knowledge, you never lost a bomber that you were escorting, is that correct?
Not to enemy fighters.
Not to enemy fighters. Well, maybe to FLAC, but you weren't there to fight FLAC. You were there to fight enemy fighters. Stand by for just a bit. We're coming up on that next break. Just under 4 minutes till we're back on. Folks, if you just tuned in, you're listening to America Armed and Free. We have the joy, the pleasure, and the very special honor of having with us retired Air Force Colonel Lee Archer, one of the original Tuskegee Airmen, part of the 332nd Pursuit Group. I did not squadron, group. I got it right now. I've been appropriately corrected, and I like to be corrected when I'm incorrect.
Should owning livestock require you to register your home with a government bureaucrat? The proposed National Animal Identification System will require you to have a chip or tag in everything from a single chicken to your Shetland pony and every animal in between. Stop this travesty now so that private property remains, well, private.
You're listening to America Armed and Free.
And welcome back to America Armed and Free on AM 690 KVOI Tucson, AM 930 KAPR Douglas, AM 1100 KFNX Cave Creek Phoenix, and AM 1240 KJAA Globe, Arizona. We have the joy, the pleasure, and the very special honor of having with us retired Air Force Colonel Lee Archer, who is one of the original Tuskegee Airmen. And I want to spend as much of the time as possible letting him do the talking, so I'm going to limit callers to one question and one question only with no follow-up. Mark, you're on the line with retired Air Force Colonel Lee Archer. Your quick question or quick comment for him, please.
Colonel, it's a pleasure. I'm a retired Air Force pilot. I was wondering if you found it interesting that in the segregation structure that they did, it may have actually allowed more men to become pilots and really establish a very strong camaraderie between them.
You're correct. I was going to come to that in our conversation. Two things happened. Number one, as I mentioned early on, not even the dumbest person in the world could think that if 450 people, all of them flunked the test. And so they put us together. It built the morale amongst our organization that we were fighting the same battle, not only overseas and in combat, but also at home. And truthfully, most of us that are still around now, this late, 60 years later, are still good friends. It has a lot to do with it. I said one of the mistakes they made was that they were trying to get rid of us. They blew it by doing the two things that I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
One, by building a special base for us, and two, by putting us all together. You hit the nail right on the head.
Mark, quick follow-up.
All I was going to say to that was the camaraderie lasts forever, and that really, really was probably the best mistake they ever made for you.
Yes, it was.
I would like to ask, if you'll pardon the pun, a counter-rotating question, and that is, if they had mainstreamed all of the black pilots, what do you think might have been the result? I mean, how might they have been received in the units?
I take it to 1947-48, when President Truman decided that one of the late rewards he was going to integrate the services. First, he made the Air Force a separate organization, and he made it the United States Air Force rather than the United States Army Air Force. And at that time, I had sisters living in New York, and they were writing me letters saying that the newspapers here and probably all over the country were saying that this President Harry Truman, by integrating the services, was destroying the greatest military machine in the history of man. I was a student at UCLA at the time for the government. They had put me in school to finish my college degree. I went in as a sophomore. And we did a study on who was quitting. And we didn't tell anyone that we were African-Americans doing the study. We just said, okay, are you quitting because of this thing? We didn't find one person that answered our query who said they were quitting because of the integration. I'm quite sure there were some that did do it. We have those people all over the world who will do something like that. But no one that we've queried said they quit because of integration. And it was rather successful. As far as I'm concerned, it's been the most successful experiment in social relations in the history of man.
You told me at one time that your friend Chappie James once told you in relation to the way you were treated, quote, "When your country is in trouble, you hold her hand no matter what," unquote. How were you able to maintain that attitude in some of the face of the very prejudicial treatment that you received? For instance, you told me one time about a train ride up through Washington, D.C., which I thought was, in today's modern context, was so aberrant in the way you were treated, and it should have been apparent at the time. How do you keep your, shall we say, composure when your country treats you poorly and you got to treat your country well.
Danny, he was a kind of special person. In fact, his family is kind of special. His son is now a lieutenant general, a young man, a solid Chappie. Chappie was an instructor when I was a cadet, and he instructed my class. He was one of the instructors, one of the black instructors that taught in primary. When I ended up in basic, I was called in by the commander, Colonel Paris, and said, hey, there's a little change. You now have two instructors in your class. They have quit being civilian instructors and are now aviation cadets, and they joined the class in basic. One was Danny James Jr., and the other was a fellow by the name of Archie Williams, an Olympic 400-meter winner. We talked this over that things had changed. Suddenly, those men had been the guards that told us when to breathe and when to open up and when to sleep and when to wake up and how to fly an airplane. And now suddenly they're in basic, and I was cadet first captain, and now I'm the one who tells everyone what they will or will not do. They adjusted to it beautifully. At one time, I was grumbling about something that happened, and I made the wild statement, I ought to quit and get out of this foolishness. And Chappie said, you wouldn't do that. How could you do it? And I said, easy. I can start flunking tests. I flunk flying tests. I'll flunk written tests. I'll be insubordinate, and they'll throw me out. I'll be on the streets in New York again in a minute. And he told me, you wouldn't do that. He said, because you believe like I believe. And that's when he made the statement. You got a right to raise hell, argue, scream, and demand everything you're entitled to. He said, but when the country's in trouble, no matter how she got there, you hold her hand. And when she's not in trouble again, when she's out of trouble, then you go back screaming and hollering. And I think this is what most of us cadets and officers in the 332nd Fighter Group believe, that it's our country. This is my country. I can trace my family back as far as anyone else in this country. And I think most of the fellas, and when I talk about myself, I'm talking about most of the fellas out of the old Tuskegee Airmen unit. A lot of them came along before me. And we know that we were successful based on what other African Americans had done prior to our being chosen for the second step in society. And we did it.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a lot of pride in what we were doing. Mainly we were patriotic.
You mentioned that you had a certain discipline about drinking from segregated water fountains. One of the things you said to me off the air, I wonder if you'd share that with the audience.
Until you see signs that say colored favorites or white people. When I was in the command and staff college at Maxwell Air Force Base, Alabama, I remember going to a large department store with my two-year-old son and my wife, and the kids. Pretty good, clean, neat, everything else, but he can't read. And he goes over to where there were two fountains, and one had a little step next to it. And he stepped on that, and a woman screamed as if she had been shot. Oh, he can't do that. He's drinking at the white fountain. And she grabbed him and pulled him off. To this day, I wonder how I retained enough sense just to take the boy and my wife and walk out of the store. I didn't even buy the curtains we wanted to get. Those sort of things do something to you. But if you take a big look at the whole thing, that somebody before me had even more trouble and more of this sort of thing happen to them than I would ever have. And that's why I tell young men and women nowadays who are of color that, okay, so you don't see these things, but someone suffered them in the past, and it's your job now to keep the thing going. And I tell the young white kids, too. It's in their hands now.
Boy, you sure know how to pass a torch, don't you?
Well, I think that's the only way it's going to happen. We're a country, and when I say this is my country, I say it belligerently because it is my country. A grandfather, and a father, I fought for the country. My son did Vietnam, my oldest son. And if there's any more wars, there'll be an archer somewhere in them if the country needs them.
Man. More people need to hear you. You do a lot of public speaking. We're only 20 seconds away from the last break of this hour. Hopefully you can stay with me.
I'm staying. The family just gave me the signal to stay.
I love it. A man who can still read the signal traffic. Bear with us for just a second, Colonel Archer. Folks, if you just tuned in, you're listening to a very special edition of America Armed and Free with Colonel Lee Archer, America's first black ace and one of the original Tuskegee Airmen from the 332nd Pursuit Group. Got it right now.
I'm Oliver North, and like you, I'm listening on America Armed and Free with Charles Heller. Civilian disarmament is an essential precedent for every dictator who engages in mass murder.
Welcome back to America Armed and Free, a very special edition of SAME on AM 690 KVOI Tucson, AM 930 KAPR Douglas, AM 1240 KJAA Globe, and AM 1100 KFNX Cave Creek Phoenix. We have the joy, the pleasure, and the very special honor of having with us retired Air Force Colonel Lee Archer, one of the original and the first black ace in the United States Army Air Corps, before it was the Air Force. And I would like to ask you very, very briefly, Colonel Archer, I don't know if you recognize that music or not, and maybe you weren't interested in watching a fictionalized version of reality, but that was the music from the television series 12 O'Clock High. Did you ever watch that?
Yes, indeed. Watched it a couple of times.
And did you find it to be fairly historically accurate, if not somewhat over-dramatized, but did it have historical accuracy to it?
It had a lot of historical accuracy. In fact, it was a excellent picture as far as I was concerned. Just like the Tuskegee Airmen movie, except for the Hollywood touches in it, it was a very fine and exact dramatization of what happened.
Well, actually, that's what our caller Tom wanted to ask you about. So, Tom, go ahead and ask Colonel Archer that quick question, if you would.
Colonel Archer?
Yes, sir.
Very rare pleasure to speak with you. Colonel, one of the best features of the Tuskegee movie I watched on the History Channel was the rare opportunity when they interviewed you and had comments on the historical facts. My question to you, sir, would you possibly consider an arrangement where you, Chuck Yeager, and Bob Hoover could tell tall tales? I think that would be a phenomenal storytelling session.
I think if he told tales, reality would be taller. But, Colonel Archer, that's a good question. Do you know Chuck Yeager and Bob Hoover?
I know them both very well. We're in an organization called the Gathering of Eagles together, and we speak at the Command and Staff College and at Maxwell Air Force Base frequently.
Tom?
Is there much history between the two of you where you've spoken jointly at various organizations?
Yes, not jointly, but one after the other. Thank you, sir.
And you have a great day, Tom. Colonel Archer, what are things that this audience could do to help preserve the history of the Tuskegee Airmen?
There's two things that I really want to make a point, that we never thought, we Tuskegee Airmen, out of 452 of us that went overseas and through combat, we lost 66 overseas that were killed in combat. 32 more were shot down and became prisoners of war. And at that time, we kept saying, okay, so we've been had again. But since then, there's been a lot of late payments, as we call them. And the country has shown that they appreciated what we did and how we did it. And they recognized it, in fact, by not only medals, but by recognition by the government, and finally by the awarding of the Congressional Gold Medal to the organization.
But that hasn't been delivered yet, has it?
It hasn't been delivered. It has been approved, incidentally, 100% in the House and the Senate, which is remarkable. So what I try to tell people is that despite all of the bad press and the bad times in the past, the things are changing. I tell anyone who will listen, and I do it when I'm overseas now with the young men, that what had been the most disgraceful organization based on racial characteristics and actions is now probably the leader in the world, especially in America, but in the whole world, on fair treatment and obviously. I was recently in Iraq and taking a look at the 332nd Fighter Expeditionary Group. Now, that's the group that was all black at one time. Now, it is what I had hoped it would always be someday. Male, female, black, white, Asian, if they're all together. And they're all being judged now on their character and their performance. Nothing else seems to matter.
Content of their character, not the color of their skin.
That's correct. And so the payments have come in the long run. So do what you have to do. Pay your debt to society and to America is, without a doubt, one of the greatest organizations in history. I can't tell you how much and how proud I am of being an American.
God, I don't think anybody could say that any better. Has the 332nd been in constant existence since World War II, or were there times when it faded in and came back?
That's what happened also. It was deactivated twice in the past, and it's back in again now, and it's one of the leading groups. It's been in Iraq two times, Iraq I and Iraq II. The organization has an outstanding record. It is what an Air Force unit should be.
You have a lot of experience. You stayed in the Air Force, I believe, till 1970, did you not?
That's correct, sir.
By 1970, had most of the bad racial attitude and mistreatment pretty much worked its way out, or did it still have a long way to go in 1970?
No, it had almost worked its way out. It started working its way out in 1948, which incidentally was before the civil rights movement became active.
It was rather foundational, though. It was one of the pivot points on which the civil rights movement was based, was it not?
That's correct. And so, doing a good job, whether you think you're going to be paid or not, we didn't think in the 30s that we were changing history. We were just doing a good job for the people who were using us, the country. And the fact that we received these payments, and when I say medals and recognition and all are what we call payments, to have someone stop you in the street and say, oh, you're a Tuskegee Airman, thank you for your service to the country, is more payment than you'll ever believe.
That's the currency of the soldier, I suppose.
Yes.
You served in the Air Force and were posted to France. Did you say you'd recently been knighted there?
Yes, I am a Chevalier of the Legion of Honor to France because of activities during the Normandy D-Day and the southern France invasion.
Were you over the beach at Normandy?
Over the air, in the air, not on the beaches. Tough deal.
Right. So you actually got to watch the Normandy invasion looking down?
Yes, looking down.
My God, I didn't know that. I do some of my research on the air, I suppose. What was your impression when you looked down and realized what you had to have known what they were going through? What went through your mind looking down at the beach as you flew over it, or were you mostly looking up for enemy aircraft?
You're mostly looking up, sir, and you really don't want to see your own people in misery. It may be a way of making it fine, but you don't pay that much attention. The really tough ones I remember were southern France invasion also, which came right along after it, and Anzio for the 99th. And you don't really pay that much attention to what's going on. You're looking at the country, and you're trying to see as far away as you can. For instance, you were talking about combat.
Mm-hmm.
We had a big combat battle over Lake Balaton that we got into, and that's Lake Balaton in Hungary. And since then, a number of German pilots who were flying combat that day, when it was one of the biggest air battles I've ever seen. I mean, your biggest worry was not that you would get shot down.
You'd run into somebody.
Some idiot would run into you. But since then, I've had four occasions in which German pilots were there then contacted me or my organization through the United States government or through other ways and said, hey, let's talk. And it indicates we were not mad at each other. We were not angry.
We only have about 20 seconds left. Would you care to give a website or any way for people to find out more, either through support or information?
I don't have a website, but the Tuskegee Airmen has a website, the Tuskegee Airmen, Inc. And you can hit that on the website, and you can also get it other ways on the computer.
Colonel Archer, that's really all the time. We're dead against the stops here. We're at water injection by now. I really appreciate your time today, the whole hour, and also your tremendous service to the country. Sir, it's an honor, a pleasure, and a pure joy to speak with you.
Thank you very much for having me. It's my pleasure to be with you.
My pleasure too, sir.
Good day, sir.
Good day. I want to encourage each and every one of you to be vigorous, not violent, vigilant, not vituperative. In liberty, I'm Charles Heller.
Take us by thy might, great God, our King.
AM 690 KVOI, Tucson. AM 1240 KJAA Globe. AM 930 KAPR Douglas. AM 1100 KFNX Cave Creek, Phoenix.